the Americans in terms of what it means to have a good political order as they work through the articles and the period of time that that leads from the Declaration to the Constitution. I think this has to do with Locke and maybe Pam's comments on Locke in the following way, that certain things are adjudicated, so to speak, on the battlefield, as Walter Byrne says, right? Locke says you just appeal to heaven. So how do you know when it... I think Tiffany's right. He talks about the dissolution of government. As far as I know, Locke doesn't say that... I mean, correct me if I'm wrong for the good of the order. He doesn't talk about it in terms of having a right to revolt. I think what he said, the sense is that government revolts like a body being sick. Your body can become unhealthy and sick, and you vomit or whatever. The political process is vomiting. It's like sausages and law. You don't want to see them made or something, right? So the political body gets sick. And when it no longer is doing what it's supposed to do, then we are allowed to assess whether now the contract still holds. We do not have this right to just demand to renegotiate the terms of the contract. We don't even have the right to negotiate what our representatives have done. I think Pam's right that Locke is with Hobbes on this, that I'm sorry, you know, you signed the contract. And this is why Hume ridicules this idea of even tacit consent. He says it's like being born on a boat in the middle of the ocean. It's like, well, you can move to Russia. What? What do you mean? Well, you're choosing to stay here, so you're choosing to consent to the laws. Tacitly, right? So this is a problem, right, about when you can revolt, even for Locke. I mean, this language is in the Declaration, but it's very, you know, you have to have a long train of abuses, and they're given reasons, and they're trying to make it intelligible, but it's not clear on Lockean grounds that it's ever intelligible. There's never a threshold where you can meet to say, oh, yes, of course, government's crappy, and now we'll revolt. You have to appeal to heaven. And I think this is instructive in the Civil War case too, right? There's just an appeal to heaven, and Walter Byrne says, well, it's settled on the battlefield. It's not settled in a court. It's not a constitutional matter, and for rightly or wrongly, this is a kind of Lockean move. There's no way to know. And if you can't pull it off, well, I guess you didn't make the appeal forcefully enough to heaven or something, right? So this is where, and I've talked too long, really briefly I want to say, this is another reason I think Rousseau, it can be a valuable resource, is that in Rousseau, you don't even have representatives at all. In other words, if you really want to govern yourself, you cannot delegate this responsibility to representatives. You have to show up, and you have to vote, and you have to participate. So Rousseau forbids representatives, forbids them, because representatives, they go off to Washington, they'll become beltway insiders, they'll develop their own general will, their own esprit de corps, and they're not going to be doing what you want them to be doing, that is representing your will. So get rid of them. Now, what that means is that political society has to be very small, because now you don't have representatives anymore. But maybe that means the way to limit government is to have small-scale political order, as opposed to a Leviathan, as opposed to something like what Locke is conceiving. Maybe that's a material constraint on government. And I think you can see this in the American idiom, right, that they want... That's not balkanization. That's just robust political life, having small-scale political order. Anyway,
I would also, to bring back something that I was bringing up at the beginning, the relationship between religion and Locke and, you know, a whole bunch of different things that we can kind of tie together here. I can't remember who brought up that they looked at the greatest men of all time as being, or the greatest thinkers, as Locke, Bacon, and Newton. We see a distinction between those three people. Locke is a political theorist, and Bacon and Newton are natural scientists. I would suggest that the very fact that a person would frame the statement to say that these are the three greatest people indicates that person saw a kinship between them that we have lost, that they believed that natural law is governed not only things like, you know, chemistry and physics, in the case of Bacon and Newton, but also governed human interactions as well, and that part of the great experiment of the scientific leap forward that was going on during the 17th century was this greater understanding of the laws that kind of govern the way that people do things, and that continued right through the Enlightenment, right? So, I mean, I think that that's really a kind of instructive thing. Mike, fire away.
Are we out of time, or...?
No, we got like 10 minutes.
Okay. So I'm like really struck by how deeply the founders were dependent on finding men of good morals. So, you know, that's the – and I don't think of that. The only solution is you have revolution or you vote a lot. And there's nothing in between for me when I look at the Constitution. And when you're an economist, you think about the role competition plays in sort of disciplining behavior. And, you know, for example, if you read John Adams' piece, he suggests out of hand, there's no role for competitive courts. You know, and it worked very well in the common law tradition, and we even have a moderately successful competitive court system today in certain aspects. But that's one way to sort of think about it. And another one is, you know, I keep thinking, why not Switzerland? You know, if you look at how much representation we have as compared to how big our country is, it's nothing like what it was during the founding. And there's no provision anywhere, and even as I read the discussions about the Constitution, that any of these sorts of competitive pressures would be there. It's just voting or revolution. And,
To kind of steer this back to the direction where we're going to be going later this afternoon, and to come back to a question that I started with, do the founders believe in equality among people? Is the Constitution a natural law document based on the concept of equality among people, which Locke seems to think is a natural law, if you see where I'm going here? Do the founders believe in equality among people? I mean, we see it right there. It's a great statement in the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, all, not some, all men are created equal, right? Do the founders actually believe that? Yeah. Jim.
I think the founders believe that all men are equal in rights to property, but not quantities of property.
So you're making the argument against Marx that the...
Yes.
Okay. Charlie.
Go ahead.
It was just a... Is this on? No. It was just a brief comment. I'm not sure if it's useful, actually. It might be a distinction without a difference, but we talked earlier a little bit of operating under natural law. It seems to me, as I went through this readings, that the intent was to operate within a system of natural law, so you kind of knew where you stood in relation to everybody else who is operating within the system. I'm not sure if that's an important distinction. Like I said, the other small point is somebody talked earlier about the idea of freedom being attained. I think my reading of these documents and my understanding of natural law is that freedom simply is. It's not something that you chase. It's something that exists and must be preserved.
But again, I mean, if you are saying that, it means that you've got to start at the starting gate the same way. Each person has to have the ability to do that. Did the founders believe that that was the case, Bob?
Yes. Well, they believed in a fundamental equality of human beings in relationship to be the relationship of ruler and ruled. In other words, when they said all men are created equal, and that was a natural law statement, they meant the divine right of kings is a false doctrine. Government does not descend from God from the top down. And they also meant, in some sense, that the whole notion of a natural aristocracy is not justified on the grounds of the fundamental equality of human beings. So the equality, as Lincoln later said, was the grounding of the belief in consent. That no man is so superior to another that he can rule that other without his consent. That was Lincoln's interpretation of what the founders meant by equality, and I think that's fairly accurate. That's what they meant by it, and that's a reflection of Locke's notion of the fundamental equality in relationship to the ruler and rule. But they did not mean, of course, that human beings were equal in all respects, in terms of talent, intelligence, virtue, moral character, and so on. And this is why I pointed to this other side of the Founding Fathers. They were elitists on another side of them, too. And even Jefferson contradicted himself by saying, on the one hand, all men are created equal. On the other hand, the best government is one which is ruled by the natural aristocracy. And he even used the phrase, natural aristocracy. But he meant that the natural aristocracy still had to gain the consent of the governed before it could actually rule. But did Jefferson think he was superior to the people? Yes. Did he think that Jefferson, Madison, Washington, Hamilton, and that elite group of founders, they were like gentlemen politicians, you know, and they were of a higher character and a higher wisdom, and they should properly be through the consent of the governed, right? So they're mixing elements of equality and inequality. They're mixing elements of consent and elitism. Okay, but the fundamental meaning of equality is you have to consent to the rulers that you live under, and it's not simply ordained by God in a kind of a feudal sense, the way people should be ruled. But they were not egalitarians in the contemporary meaning of the term, and they certainly did not believe that government's job was to make people more equal, but they also believed in some, you know, they believed in equality of opportunity, a world open to talents, and they also thought that education in some way, Jefferson thought public education was an important thing. So equality of opportunity, they certainly believed in, but not equality in the contemporary senses of equality of result, or that all human beings ought to wind up at the same place.
But there is, I mean, there is an awesome and massive problem here that's built into the Constitution. Yeah, Mark, you wanted to make a quick comment?
Just a brief comment. If the founders deny the divine right of kings, and I agree they did, on what basis then were men endowed by their creator with inalienable rights or unalienable rights? How did they reconcile attacking the divine right of kings and then turning around and saying, well, God didn't will that, but he willed this? How did they know?
I think they made the argument that human beings have an inherent intelligence. Every human being has enough intelligence, enough freedom of will, and enough enlightened self-interest that in most matters they could make the decisions about how to govern themselves, and in other matters they would delegate that to representatives, and the representatives would be making judgments, refining and enlarging their opinion. But yeah, it is, I mean, you're right in saying they rejected the divine right of kings and they rejected theocracy, but they thought that God was the author of the natural law that made human beings equal. So they did not remove God completely from the foundation of the natural law, which was the foundation of the Declaration. It's not really in the Constitution. The natural law is not in the Constitution. You could argue it's in the Bill of Rights to some degree. But even there, it's not mentioned. They only mention the Bill of Rights. There's a reference to common law in the Seventh Amendment. Some people argue the Ninth and the Tenth Amendments are implicit natural law. You know, reserved rights and reserved powers, whatever is not in the document itself is out there.
Well, again,
but there's no references to natural law in the Constitution, unlike the Declaration.
But I think that most of the amendments, like, you know, the First, the Fifth, these are all statements of natural law positions. I'm just saying that where do they derive the idea that people have the right to free speech? I would say that they believe that this is a natural law position as much as anything else, not simply that they are giving it to the people. We're just making sure that we understand that people have that right, and we want the federal government to say it right at the beginning before we enter into this contract. But anyway, we got a couple more people before we got to turn it over. So Tiffany, Pamela, and Jen.
Yeah, coming back to how did they know? What is the basis of freedom? What is the basis of our rights? If you recur to Locke, he suggests that man's natural freedom is the consequence of his equality. Equality in what sense? And I think it comes back to what Robert was just saying, that there's a certain minimal threshold of reason that Locke makes the basis of freedom, and that you can see this in a couple of ways. And I want to emphasize, so there's an equality of reason to a certain degree. And I think you can see that in the second treatise in a couple of ways, one of which is he suggests that there are adults who, by virtue of some defect, do not possess reason, and they are to remain permanent wards of their parents. So in other words, even when they attain physiological adulthood, being deprived of the exercise of their reason, they are not to be put in the enjoyment of freedom that adults amongst themselves should enjoy. He also makes that point, I think, very firmly with regard to children. This is, children are subject to those who have begotten them. Parents have an obligation to those children, but those children have an obligation to obey their parents and are only to be put in the enjoyment of their freedom when they have attained the age of reason. And that's an important part of what parents are doing, is cultivating the development of their children's reason, at least in some minimal ways. So that it appears to me, at any rate, that our freedom is contingent upon the possession of some minimal threshold of reason, though Locke doesn't polish up that requirement to the full development of our reason, in which case no one would probably be free, but a very small few.
Okay. Pamela.
Just
talk to the microphone.
Suggestions for further reading. one, following up on what Bob said, I can't quite remember the precise language, but if we wanted to see what the founders thought about equality and inequality, perhaps we could start by looking at Federalist Paper number 10, where Madison specifically says that the purpose of government is to protect the inequality among different types and amounts of property. And I think that leads to the sort of contest that we have today between, as Bob was suggesting, equality of opportunity or equality of result. And the other suggestion for further reading I might make, in line with what Tiffany said earlier about looking at the whole of Locke, maybe, and you brought it up too, Chris, the importance of religion itself at the time of the founding of liberalism. And I don't think that it is as dominant in the American founders as it is in Locke, solving the religious slash political problem. So that if we read the letter, a letter on toleration, a letter concerning toleration, as a supplemental piece to the Second Treatise, I think that that also helps to broaden our view about what was at stake if you start from the premise that the law of nature's fundamental proposition is the preservation of mankind, of all mankind.
Jen and Elaine, and just quick comments, please.
So I'd like to suggest that we're perhaps not recognizing a difference between natural rights and natural law, and that even going beyond that, that there's a way in which we could think about natural law that is a little bit different and I think very instructive. So natural rights, I think, are these things that we're talking about, you know, the equality of man and the inalienable rights that he possesses just from being man, right? And natural law might be something a little bit different, something about the sort of like the laws of physics. You have the laws of human nature, so things that you can expect human beings to do because they are human beings, right? So you have rights and then you have expected patterns of behavior. And I think that you actually see both of these things in the founders. You see the recognition of natural rights, but you also really see the recognition that human beings behave in certain predictable ways that we can expect when we enslave someone, we can expect them to try to escape, right, or something like this. And that knowledge of what human beings do is useful in trying to craft a political system. And that's why you see, going back to, I think, one of your earlier comments, this putting Bacon and Newton and Locke together in the same place is because Locke is seen as a scientist here, right? And a political scientist, and this is, you know, political science in the sense that we're going to take these laws of human behavior, right, and use them as an input into designing our political system. Recognizing how man is going to act when faced with certain choices is necessary to designing our political system. And I think that Locke, you know, recognizing this is perhaps one of the great things that we have kind of forgotten in terms of John Adams has the same recognition, right? I don't think it's so un-Lockean. And if this arises out of Locke, then I think that the influence of Locke on the Constitution is much greater than we've given it credit for.
And Elaine?
Very briefly, I think in considering whether or not the founders believed that all men are created equal, we need to recognize that not only are there differences in the interpretation of equality, but also interpretations of man. Does man embrace woman, as we would say in England? And does it embrace non-Caucasians? Those clearly were fundamental questions.
Some men embrace women. I've been asked to read this from somebody in the audience, which just goes to show that we need to turn this over to the audience now. We're at time. But from Jefferson, a right to property, quote from Jefferson, a right to property is founded in our natural wants, in the means with which we are endowed to satisfy these wants, and the right to what we acquire by those means without violating the similar rights of other sensible beings. So, questions?
Hello, I'm Sarah Larson. I'm from Hamilton College. The first question asked in today's session was, are humans born free? And as Professor Riquette has taught his entire class, Southern conservative John C. Calhoun would argue that no, they are born fragile and dependent. True, I guess. And earlier it was brought up that the government, whether or not government is natural or whether or not it's a consciously created social contract. And I guess I'm confused at who would think that it is the latter, that it is a consciously created social contract. And if that is the case, is that a global sentiment? I'm thinking about like China or, you know, like other like really poor third world countries, or is it just a cultural and unique sentiment to the United States?
Lee?
I don't think that any of the founders, and I don't think most political theorists, would ever have thought that the social contract was a description of historical fact. It was rather a thought experiment, a way of trying to understand in what way government might be understood to be legitimate. And so the fact that governments have evolved naturally in different ways, in different circumstances, in different places, is not incompatible with the idea of a social contract in the way that it's used by political philosophers.
Hi, I'm Alex Armlovich from AHI Rochester. I wanted to sort of repose Professor Rizzo's earlier question from very, very near the beginning of the discussion when he was asking about what an individual could do in the case of the convicted murderer and his jailer. My understanding was that once you're bound by the social construct, by the social contract, that that you are sort of bound to follow those laws. But that only in the state of nature is it that when you're harmed by someone that you could take them as slaves or you could kill them or whatever it be in the state of nature. And so I sort of wanted to understand what it actually means. Is it only that the government, is it that the state can't violate these rights or that people still can? So how does it work? Is it a public morality, a private morality? And just sort of, if we could sort of defuse those aspects of it, I'm just curious.
Well, one thing, this, I know that this is a controversial topic. Does Hobbes or Locke say you get to retain the right of self-preservation? And I think that actually Hobbes may give you far more latitude in that regard than Locke. I mean, for instance, Hobbes says if you're a timid person, and you've been required to go to war, if it's not an existential threat, you may run away. And it is Hobbes who says you may also run away from your executioner. But Locke says, I think, look, if you forfeited your life because you've been taken into slavery and you are essentially a dead man walking, it's the state of war. So whenever you find yourself in a situation of slavery, your life is so precarious, you don't really have any actual hope of survival. But sure, if you want to escape, if you want to try to escape the gallows by running away, or you want to try to escape slavery by running away, you can do it. But that is a freedom left for somebody who is just a kind of a shell of a human. I mean, that's at least where I would begin, but I'm also happy to defer.
Flag or Mark, which one? I guess I'm of the opinion there's a little more space in Locke in response to your question. I think Locke says we give up once we enter into political society, we give up the right to punish transgressors, but we don't give up the right to self-preservation wholly. That right is regulated now by the state, but it's not wholly transferred. So I think there's more space to revolt in Locke than other people have said.
Kevin.
Yeah, I mean, it may depend on what we mean to be enslaved. You know, I mean, Locke does say slavery is just a continuation of the state of war, and not all conditions in the state of nature are the state of war for Locke. But slavery is one of them. And in the state of nature, much less the state of war, you have that absolute right of preservation. It may be that in civil society we don't any longer have that unlimited absolute right, that we've given it up. So it may depend on how far we're willing to go to say that we're enslaved by the modern state or something. It is all your private-public point, I think, is a good one. In both Hobbes and Locke, government remains in the state of nature. It remains with an unlimited right. Right. So it's a kind of we're in different categories. Right. So.
And one short comment from Mike. Mike Rizzo?
Yeah.
Did you want it?
Yeah.
Got
him.
Okay.
All right, so I'm curious, how do we actually enter into a social contract? I work at a bank, and the way you give someone fiduciary responsibility over your accounts is you sign a power of attorney document. So what are the arguments for how we actually enter into a social contract?
Well, I can actually give you a really simple one. Anyone here familiar with fraternity system? Okay, so there's a social contract there, and so you decide whether or not you want to join this club, right? So there are explicit things that are required of you when you do this. There are also tacit things that are required of you when you join this. And so it is a very limited social contract in that the society that you're forming is very small and well-defined and clear. So do you mean that not necessarily the, in general what a social contract is, or do you mean that, how do you form a social contract with something as big as the United States with 330 million people? Is that what you mean?
How are we all consenting to social contract?
Okay, so I think as Elaine said earlier, that that it's not necessarily that the social contract exists as in it's something that we have all consented to. But the project or the experiment is to imagine if we would have consented to it, right, if we were given the option. And if you can actually come to the conclusion that the answer is yes, then we have a means of judging our government, right? We can say, okay, then this is in fact a good government because we would have agreed to sign this contract. Right. Now, whether we can actually ever say that is a totally different thing. But that is the project, right, is to determine whether we could have said yes to this contract.
It was Elaine and then.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Very quickly, another example of a limited social contract is if you ever join a condo association or a homeowners association. Again, very specific. It's an actual legal document that you have to sign as a condition of purchasing property in that group. And to the point about consent, there are many who would argue that consent has not been given. Consider, for example, the works of Spooner, Lysander Spooner.
We have Elaine. We just had Elaine. Adam, Jim, and then Bob.
One other item for further reading would be like Plato's Crito, where Crito wants to break Socrates out of jail, on the last night, and Socrates says, "What would the laws say to me after I had the opportunity to leave the society and the laws for my whole life, and I didn't? Now I'm just going to run away." And so we're not really like all on a boat and with no chance of exit. We actually do kind of have some kind of exit, and that moral question, it does kind of become more of a metaphorical or moral question that, we did stay here, and we did have some opportunity. Now, it takes a while to get to the point where you actually have a significant ability to exit, and where else can you go? And so, there are problems that come up, but, if you're just thinking metaphorically, we're here.
Well, the short answer to your question is the ratifying conventions, which ratified the U.S. Constitution. I mean, each of the colonies, which became states, elected representatives to the ratifying conventions, which was authorized in Article 7 of the Constitution, and that was a consent of the people in a fairly formal and regularized way. We also have the Mayflower Compact, when the pilgrims were on the boat before they got off at Cape Cod for their first vacation at Cape Cod, that's a joke, and because it wasn't a vacation. But, there are different words for social contract. There's compact, there's pact, there's, ratifying convention, pardon me?
Covenant.
Covenant, right? I don't quite agree with you that many of the social contract think it was a hypothetical thought experiment to think of the best possible way in which we could legitimize power and authority. People consent to it. No one thought there would ever be 100% consent, you know, that every individual said, yes, I agree to this particular government. But there are historical examples, both as kind of confederations and federations and even things like the Mayflower Compact, which looks like sort of individuals together agreeing that these are the rules by which we're going to govern ourselves. So there are historical examples. But look, the Constitution was legitimate because of the ratifying conventions, and that's a social contract.
We got to go to the audience. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Max Schnidman, Hamilton College. Professor Krainak, you mentioned that one of the key factors in the founding was freedom of will, and we see a bit of that reflected in Locke's essay on understanding. Later critics of Locke, like Hume, Berkeley, and to a lesser extent Leibniz, attack this idea, arguing for determinism, or at least in Hume's case, compatibilism. We also see modern philosophers like Dennett arguing similarly. So my question is, saying that compatibilism or determinism is true and we don't really have free will, how does this impact our notion of freedom, particularly with its relation to limited government?
That's like a really hard question. You know, I think Locke was equivocal about freedom of the will. I mean, people argue about was he a strict materialist? I mean, he thought consciousness to some degree, you know, was sort of more or less reducible to what people would call the brain today. But I think he was kind of neutral or agnostic on that. He certainly believed in choice. Whether choice was ultimately predetermined by some causal mechanism like Hobbes thought, were purely just like mechanical men, I don't think Locke thought that, and I think he was kind of agnostic on that question. But your larger point, you know, it's a big question today by people like Daniel Dennett and people who believe very strongly, you know, in the genetic foundation of personality, as to whether or not this should impact the law, for example. And you know, that's a very difficult question. I don't think they'll ever prove, I mean, if you just want my opinion, I mean, I don't think they'll ever prove that the mind is reducible to the brain. So in other words, all of the efforts by people to combine the study of genes with the study of artificial intelligence, they'll never realize that project that Hobbes and maybe even someone like B.F. Skinner to some degree thought, you know, that man is just a kind of a complicated machine. So I'm not worried about that. But there are people who are worried about it because they actually do, they do believe that we're more or less predetermined by our genetic endowment and the influence of the environment, and that finally the brain is going to be, you know, reducible to some kind of artificial intelligence. If that were true, then yes, that would pose a fundamental theoretical problem for freedom, right? Freedom of the will. I'm not worried about that, but I know people are.
Kev?
Yeah, I mean, it clearly has policy implications, right? I mean, if we have freedom or we don't, right? A lot of the people that work on this problem are not thinking in terms of the policy. I asked Patricia Churchill once when she was at William & Mary giving a talk. She's what's called an eliminative materialist. That is, the mind is just the brain. There is no real kind of, there's nothing above and beyond that. Consciousness as kind of an emergent property. She denies that. Consciousness on some kind of level of like quantum indeterminacy denies that, right? So the things are determined. The mind is just the brain. And I asked her, I said, you know, Tocqueville says the doctrines of the materialists are pernicious. Now, he doesn't say that they're false, right? But he says that they're pernicious. And I said, you know, Professor Churchland, do you think it's a good idea, whether or not it's true, to tell people that they're not responsible for what they do and that, right, they have no really kind of freedom? She said, well, that's a good question. So you see, on the one hand, right, this kind of, this attempt to understand the world, being detached totally from like what Weaver says, ideas have consequences. So yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Of course, if we have no free will, politics looks very different, right? But I'm not sure the question will be settled despite, I mean, materialism is very old. It's one of the oldest philosophical ideas, and it keeps coming back and keeps coming back. It may be true. I guess Tocqueville's point is that whether or not it's true, it is a politically harmful belief, right? Maybe as Kant says, whether or not we are free or even know that we're free, we have to believe that we're free, or morality doesn't make sense at all, right?
I'm going to go back to the student. There's another question. Yeah, Scott.
Hi, Scott Milne, Hamilton College. So this is an intentionally broad question. I just want to see what some of you do with it. But George Carey raises in his article the question whether our constitutional system is anchored, so to speak, on virtue or self-interest. And I was wondering if it's either or, if it's a combination of both, where you see virtue coming in to political life. Some thoughts on that.
Jim.
I think it's probably a mixture of both, but I would see as an economist the emphasis on rights of property and regulation of interstate commerce and those kinds of things, that it's strongly self-interest.
Can I make a comment about that? Because I wish, did you go to the speech by Roger Kimball last night, the keynote address? Because he posed the difference between conservative and liberals as, on the one hand, liberals believe in benevolence and a kind of, which they equate with virtue. And on the other side, he said conservatives believe in self-interest. And a student, you know, challenged him on that and said, well, you're just reducing the conservative position to self-interest. And I said afterward to Roger Kimball, I said, you did a little bit of a disservice to the conservative position because there are virtues associated with self-interest, okay? And self-interest is not the same thing as selfishness or egotism. And let's call them the bourgeois virtues or the virtues that go along middle-class virtues. And the founders talk about them, like thrift, frugality, hard work, industry, planning ahead, rationality, all of the things that we find, for example, in Benjamin Franklin, if you've ever read his autobiography, and his chart of virtues. And these chart of virtues are bourgeois virtues or middle-class virtues or the virtues of a capitalist society. So I would prefer to frame the debate more about different kinds of virtue, you see. There are virtues of a middle-class capitalistic society, and then there are virtues of a more of a Roman society, and America has had both. You know, one of the amazing things about America I've always found is that you could talk to someone who looks like he's just a guy working in an office in an insurance company, and you'll find out he fought in the Battle of Iwo Jima in World War II, and that he combines bourgeois virtues of industry, thrift, frugality, and so on with what the Romans would call heroic virtue. And I think that's America. You know, we've had this incredible combination. And then there are the religious virtues, the theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity, giving money to the poor. So I think my opening comment, America is a rich combination of three or four or five different traditions, and we draw virtues from all of these different traditions. And there are even virtues found in the notion of self-interest and enlightened self-interest, and it shouldn't just be reduced to mere selfishness. Although there are greedy capitalists who aren't particularly virtuous, and, you know, we've seen some bad effects of those people.
Elaine?
And even more greedy politicians. Right. I would suggest that if interest, self-interest and if virtue are properly understood, they need not be in conflict. And that was one of the important understandings that is supposed to be conveyed by the notion of enlightened self-interest. But the big question facing us, if we're considering limited government, is what role should government have in pursuing all of those?
Right.
And I think that remains on the table for the rest of today and tomorrow and many more hours.
Yeah, I hope we're going to debate that. Yeah.
Tiffany, I've got you on the line, but can we just go to the...
Yeah, sure.
Thanks. We've only got a couple of minutes left, so...
Hi, Jason Birnbaum from University of Rochester. I was hoping you guys could help me reconcile some ideas about natural law. And it seems that natural law is something that exists, and it's meant for us to discover it, and it's out there, and we need to find it somehow. But the laws in our society seem to have come about through an evolutionary process where things change slowly over time and we develop new institutions. And an evolutionary process doesn't really have a goal in mind, doesn't have this natural law goal in the end. So what is the best way of getting to a natural law if a process of evolutionary law leaves with it like flaws in there and things that we don't necessarily know why they're there, imperfections? So what is the best way to find this natural law?
Don't all jump in.
I'll just say very, very briefly, I think it depends on what you mean by nature, right? And I think in the evolutionary idea, you may have a different, there may be two different conceptions of nature there that are not easily, if at all, compatible, right? An idea of natures that do not change and an idea of natures that are always changing, right? So,
Jennifer.
So I think I would like to dig in a little bit more about, you know, where you're going with this, and I'll give you an example to maybe help frame the discussion. So you have the market order, right, which is going to have some sort of outcomes. Efficiency maybe is an outcome. So, and by efficiency, I mean resources are allocated to the place where they're valued highest, right? And so you see that order emerge through no intention of anyone, right, because you have natural human tendencies to do certain things, you know, like learn from your mistakes and economize and whatnot. And not just the natural human tendencies, but also the legal structure that makes it more profitable to seek your self-interest through trade rather than through predation, right? Stealing from others. So those two sort of things, so that the human tendencies plus the legal system lead to something like efficiency, right? So you have this thing that's good that we think of as good that emerged out of an evolutionary spontaneous process, okay? So if you want to try to apply that to law, to natural law, I'm not sure. So you're thinking of natural law almost like efficiency, like that is the ideal outcome that we're looking for. Am I right about that?
I guess so, yeah. That sounds appropriate.
Okay. So
if justice
is the ultimate outcome of society and we get there by framing ourselves in a kind of Thomistic sense, we get there by aligning ourselves with natural law the best way that we can.
Okay, so if natural law it represents the same kind of ideal that efficiency does in that sense, then because it's the best way for justice, you know. If that's the case, then what you would need to look for would be variation and selection mechanisms, right? If, like efficiency, we can't identify it from the outset. We don't know. If we could know, then we would just do it, right? We don't know what the efficient allocation of resources is. But what we do know is that the legal system combined with the tendency of human beings lead us towards something like efficiency. And so what you would need to look for, and Hayek does this, I don't know if you've read Law, Legislation, and Liberty, Volume 1, but you should if you haven't. Hayek talks about how the common law system is sort of an evolutionary process like this, where you have competition, where you have variation, various people coming up with different legal systems, and then you have selection. You have competition, and then one is chosen over another according to the fitness, right, the propensity towards justice. So if you have that kind of a variation and selection system, then you could approach something like efficiency in law, something like natural law. But I think that's really up for debate as to whether or not we can have that sort of competitive process in law.
Yeah, Charlie, just briefly.
Yeah, this overlaps with Jen's answer. I think Adam Smith talked about it in the theory of moral sentiments as well. I think natural law is, kind of the constant maybe, and then the actual laws themselves, the specific laws, sort of emerge as people begin to group together based on their shared mutual sympathies. And that's the best environment for experimentation, so you can test things and see what works. Hayek talked about it, not to harken back to the first discussion, but as, you know, the resting society on a single giant pillar, it would have to be enormous, and it's probably not even possible anyway. Well, it's definitely not even possible anyway to encompass, you know, the entire shared knowledge of human experience in one place or posit it with one institution. So I think that, you know, under natural law, laws themselves are emergent.
Okay, one more question.
Hi, Alexander de Moulin, Hamilton College. So the idea that government, the purpose of government is both to maintain liberty and virtue came up both in the last session and this session. And my question was, how does this correspond to the idea of happiness, especially as we see in Adam's thoughts on government? He says that the happiness of society is the end of government, as all divines and moral philosophers will agree that the happiness of the individual is the end of man. So I was wondering if this conflicts with the idea that the government, the purpose of government, especially limited government, is to maintain virtue, and also whether or not this idea of the maintenance of happiness or the pursuit of happiness contributed to the creation of the Minotaur that we're talking about.
Go ahead, Elaine.
I think the Adams conception here is incompatible with the notion of government having as its sole end the protection of liberty. The happiness that he's talking about is much closer to the ancient notion of, sorry, go back. The way he phrases it here, he sounds tremendously like the utilitarians. He's talking actually about maximizing the happiness, the greatest happiness of the greatest number. That doesn't automatically presuppose virtue, though I think if one reads more into the Adams, it is clear that he has a much greater notion of what underlies this happiness. To the extent that one is talking about the promotion of virtue, he is claiming here that virtue will lead to happiness. This depends tremendously on how one interprets those various terms. It's much too late in the session to go into that in any more further detail. Right.
Actually, I think that's a good place to just stop for lunch. So we have a lunch out in the atrium. Please come along, help yourself. And we'll be meeting back here at, what time is the next session? Is it 4 o'clock? At 4 o'clock? Okay, we'll see you at 4.